Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 497, titled Nightmare. This has been recorded on January 30th of the year 2005. We have a lot of material to cover, so I'm not going to take a lot of time to discuss the websites. WFMU is archiving the For the Record shows on Real Audio on two websites. The ever-growing Spitfire website has thousands of pages of printed material, including the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, all kinds of resources, a search function, links to various websites, including one maintained by listeners in the Midwest that documents the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry, and last but certainly not least, a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. A lot of people who hear the depressing information that I have to present, and I think today's this broadcast will be as depressing as any I've ever done, get frustrated. And they say, well, what can I do? Well, one of the things you can do is to support the work that I'm doing, because unless there is an unfettered, free, and widely distributed means of communication, public communication, it's over, folks. And I don't think there's a better outlet, frankly, than yours truly. With that advisory, we're going to take a look at a nightmare scenario that is unfolding for the United States, for the world. It has a Middle Eastern component, and unless this situation is turned around, basically, things ain't going to work, folks. We're going to begin with an article that was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. This is from a website called Information Clearinghouse. It's an article written by a fellow named Mark Gaffney, G-A-F-F-N-E-Y. It's a very important article, a very scary article, but it has a few prejudices in it, but it's a very important article and a very scary article. There's been a lot of saber rattling in the Persian Gulf concerning the growing Iranian nuclear capability. There have been public pronouncements by various sources saying this is unacceptable. There have been a number of hypothetical scenarios advanced, including the U.S. invading Iran, which is ridiculous, or invading Saudi Arabia or something else, where the U.S. hasn't got enough troops to handle what's going on in Iraq, for crying out loud. But there has also been a scenario of a preemptive military strike by the Israelis on the Iranian nuclear capability. And what we're going to be looking at is a potential nightmare scenario in the Middle East, if indeed the war of words turns into a war of missiles. This article is titled Iran, A Bridge Too Far, subtitled The Weapon That Could Defeat the U.S. in the Gulf. What this is about is an area of military technology that Russia has far out, in which the Russia has far outpaced the United States, namely ship-killing cruise missiles. Specifically, what we're going to be looking at in this article is the potential of two Russian ship-killing cruise missiles, the Sunburn missile and also another larger missile called the Yakonst. These are missiles that are far in advance of anything the U.S. has. We have no proven countermeasures for these, and Russia has been selling these to Iran in the event that either there is a preemptive military strike by Israel or if the U.S. does something. It could lead to the scenario that is presented here, and it is a very, very unpleasant scenario. After reading this article, I'm going to read another article. It's actually a text of a speech given by Bill Moyers when he received an award given to him by the Harvard Medical School. It's about the fundamentalist Christian influence in the contemporary government, what I call the Armageddon lobby, and in particular the Armageddon lobby's implications for not only the Middle East, but for the environmental situation here at home. And this is indeed a nightmare. So, sweet dreams. This article, again, researched for us by a member of the listening audience, is called Iran, A Bridge Too Far, subtitled The Weapon That Could Defeat the U.S. and the Gulf. It's by Mark Gaffney, G-A-F-F-N-E-Y. It's dated 10/26/04. And after discussing massive U.S. fleet operations around the world in the summer of 2004, it talks about the reason for those. Skipping down, the news headlines about the joint maneuvers in the South China Sea read, "Saber-rattling unnerves China, and huge show of force worries Chinese." But the reality was quite different, and as we shall see, has grave ramifications for the continuing U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf. Because Operation Summer Pulse reflected a high-level Pentagon decision that an unprecedented show of strength was needed to counter what is viewed as a growing threat, in the particular case of China because of Peking's newest Sovremenny-class destroyers recently acquired from Russia. Nonsense, you are probably thinking. That's impossible. How could a few Picayune destroyers threaten the U.S. Pacific Fleet? Here's where the story thickens. Summer Pulse amounted to a tacit acknowledgement, obvious to anyone paying attention, that the United States has been eclipsed in an important area of military technology, and that this qualitative edge is now being wielded by others, including the Chinese, because those otherwise very ordinary destroyers were, in fact, launching platforms for Russian-made 3M-82 Moskit anti-ship cruise missiles, NATO designation SSN-22 Sunburn, a weapon for which the U.S. Navy currently has no defense. Here, I am not suggesting that the U.S. status of lone world superpower has been surpassed. I am simply saying that a new global balance of power is emerging in which other individual states may on occasion achieve an asymmetric advantage, unquote, over the U.S. And this, in my view, explains the immense scale of Summer Pulse. The U.S. show last summer of overwhelming strength was calculated to send a message. I was shocked when I learned the facts about these Russian-made cruise missiles. The problem is that so many of us suffer from two common misperceptions. The first follows from our assumption that Russia is militarily weak as a result of the breakup of the old Soviet system. Actually, this is accurate, but it does not reflect the complexities. Although the Russian Navy continues to rust in port and the Russian Army is in disarray, in certain key areas, Russian technology is actually superior to our own. And nowhere is this truer than in the vital area of anti-ship cruise missile technology, where the Russians hold at least a 10-year lead over the U.S. The second misperception has to do with our complacency in general about missiles as weapons, probably attributable to the pathetic performance of Saddam Hussein's Scuds during the first Gulf War, a dangerous illusion that I will now attempt to rectify. Many years ago, Soviet planners gave up trying to match the U.S. ship for ship, gun for gun, and dollar for dollar. The Soviets simply could not compete with the high levels of U.S. spending required to build up and maintain a huge naval armada. They shrewdly adopted an alternative approach based on strategic defense. They searched for weaknesses and sought relatively inexpensive ways to exploit those weaknesses. The Soviets succeeded by developing several supersonic anti-ship missiles, one of which, the SSN-22 Sunburn, has been called the most lethal missile in the world today, unquote. Parenthetically, it is this SSN-22 Sunburn and an even more advanced, specifically designed carrier-killer missile, the Akhonts, which are the focal point of this very scary scenario. Continuing. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, the old military establishment fell upon hard times. But in the late 1990s, Moscow awakened to the underutilized potential of its missile technology to generate desperately needed foreign exchange. A decision was made to resuscitate selected programs, and very soon Russian military technology became a hot export commodity. Today, Russian missiles are a growth industry generating much-needed cash for Russia, with many billions in combined sales to India, China, Vietnam, Cuba, and also Iran. In the near future, this dissemination of advanced technology is likely to present serious challenges to the U.S. Some have even warned that the U.S. Navy's largest ships, the massive carriers, have now become floating death traps and should, for this reason, be mothballed. The Sunburn missile has never seen use in combat, to my knowledge, which probably explains why its fearsome capabilities are not more widely recognized. Other cruise missiles have been used, of course, on several occasions with devastating results. During the Falklands War, French-made Exocet missiles fired from Argentine fighters sunk the HMS Sheffield and another ship. And in 1987, during the Iran-Iraq War, the USS Stark was nearly cut in half by a pair of Exocets while on patrol in the Persian Gulf. On that occasion, U.S. Aegis radar picked up the incoming Iraqi fighter, a French-made Mirage, and tracked its approach to within 50 miles. The radar also saw the Iraqi plane turn around and return to its base, but radar never detected the pilot launch his weapons. The sea-skimming Exocets came smoking in under radar and were only sighted by human eyes moments before they ripped into the Stark, crippling the ship and killing 37 U.S. sailors. The 1987 surprise attack on the Stark exemplifies the dangers posed by anti-ship cruise missiles. And the dangers are much more serious in the case of the Sunburn, whose specks leave the subsonic exoset in the dust. Not only is the Sunburn much larger and faster, it has far greater range and a superior guidance system. Those who have witnessed its performance trials invariably come away stunned. According to one report, when the Iranian Defense Minister Ali Shamkhani visited Moscow in October of 2001, he requested a test firing of the Sunburn, which the Russians were only too happy to arrange. So impressed was Ali Shamkhani that he placed an order for an undisclosed number of the missiles. The Sunburn can deliver a 200-kiloton nuclear payload or a 750-pound conventional warhead within a range of 100 miles, more than twice the range of the exoset. The Sunburn combines a Mach 2.1 speed, two times the speed of sound, with a flight pattern that hugs the deck and includes violent end maneuvers, unquote, to elude enemy defenses. The missile was specifically designed to defeat the U.S. Aegis radar defense system. Should a U.S. Navy Phalanx Point Defense somehow manage to detect an incoming Sunburn missile, the system has only seconds to calculate a fire solution, not enough time to take out the intruding missile. The U.S. Phalanx Defense employs a six-barreled gun that fires 3,000 depleted uranium rounds a minute, but the gun must have precise coordinates to destroy an intruder just in time, unquote. The Sunburn's combined supersonic speed and payload size produce tremendous kinetic energy on impact, with devastating consequences for ship and crew. A single one of these missiles can sink a large warship, yet costs considerably less than a fighter jet. Although the Navy has been phasing out the older Phalanx defense system, its replacement, known as the Rolling Action Missile, or RAM, has never been tested against the weapon it seems destined to one day face in combat. The U.S. Navy's only plausible defense against a robust weapon like the Sunburn missile is to detect the enemy's approach well ahead of time, whether destroyers, subs, or fighter bombers, and defeat them before they can get in range and launch their deadly cargo. For this purpose, U.S. AWACS radar planes assigned to each naval battle group are kept aloft on a rotating schedule. The planes, quote, see, unquote, everything from 200 miles of the fleet and are complemented with intelligence from orbiting satellites. But U.S. naval commanders operating in the Persian Gulf face serious challenges that are unique to the littoral, i.e., coastal environment. A glance at a map shows why. The Gulf is nothing but a large lake, with one narrow outlet, and most of its northern shore, i.e., Iran, consists of mountainous terrain that affords a commanding tactical advantage over ships operating in Gulf waters. The rugged northern shore makes for easy concealment of coastal defenses such as mobile missile launchers, and also makes their detection problematic. Although it was not widely reported, the U.S. actually lost the Battle of the Scuds in the first Gulf War, termed the Great Scud Hunt, and for similar reasons. Saddam Hussein's multiple Scud launchers proved so difficult to detect and destroy over and over again, the Iraqis fooled Allied reconnaissance with decoys, that during the course of Desert Storm, the U.S. was unable to confirm even a single kill. This proved such an embarrassment to the Pentagon afterwards that the unpleasant stats were buried in official reports. But the blunt fact is the U.S. failed to stop the Scud attacks. The launches continued until the last days of the conflict. Luckily, the Scud's inaccuracy made it an almost useless weapon. At one point, General Norman Schwarzkopf quipped dismissively to the press that his soldiers had a greater chance of being struck by lightning in Georgia than by a Scud in Kuwait. But that was then, and it would be a grave error to allow the Scud's ineffectiveness to blur the facts concerning this other missile. The Sunburn's amazing accuracy was demonstrated not long ago in a live test staged by at sea by the Chinese and observed by U.S. spy planes. Not only did the Sunburn missile destroy the dummy target ship, it scored a perfect bullseye hitting the crosshairs of a large X mounted on the ship's bridge. The only word that does it justice, awesome, has become a cliché, hackneyed from hyperbolic excess. The U.S. Navy has never faced anything in combat as formidable as the Sunburn missile. But this will surely change if the U.S. and Israel decide to wage a so-called preventive war against Iran to destroy its nuclear infrastructure. Storm clouds have been darkening over the Gulf for many months. In recent years, Israel upgraded its air force with a new fleet of long-range F-15 fighter bombers, and even more recently took delivery of 5,000 bunker buster bombs from the U.S., weapons that many observers think are intended for use against Iran. The arming for war has been matched by threats. Israeli officials have declared repeatedly that they will not allow the mullahs to develop nuclear power, not even reactors to generate electricity for peaceful use. Their threats are particularly worrisome because Israel has a long history of preemptive war. Never mind that such a determination is not Israel's to make and belongs instead to the international community as codified in the Non-Proliferation Treaty. With regard to Iran, the International Atomic Energy Agency's, or IAEA's, recent report, September 2004, is well worth a look as it repudiates facile claims by the U.S. and Israel that Iran is building bombs. By the way, I've seen this report. This really depends on what source you're looking at. And it's, of course, one of the problems that we face here in this country and, you know, in others. What source do you believe? But in any event, it's a small matter here because if, in fact, there's unilateral nuclear military action, it's very likely to result in the nightmare that I'm going to be setting forth here. Continuing. While the report is critical of Tehran for its ambiguities and its grudging release of documents, it affirms that IAEA inspectors have been admitted to every nuclear site in the country to which they have sought access without exception. Last year, Iran signed the strengthened IAEA inspection protocol, which until then had been voluntary. And the IAEA has found no hard evidence to date either that bombs exist or that Iran has made a decision to build them. In a talk on October 3, 2004, IAEA Director General Mohammad El-Baradei made the clearest statement yet, quote, "Iran has no nuclear weapons program," he said, and then repeated himself for emphasis. "Iran has no nuclear weapons program, but I personally don't rush to conclusions before all the realities are clarified. So far as I see, nothing that could be called an imminent danger. I have seen no nuclear weapons program in Iran. What I have seen is that Iran is trying to get access to nuclear enrichment technology, and so far there is no danger from Iran. Therefore, we should make use of political and diplomatic means before thinking of resorting to other alternatives." That, by the way, is something that I very much agree with. Skipping down. If a showdown over Iran develops in the coming months, the man who could hold the outcome in his hands will be thrust upon the world stage. That man, like him or hate him, is Russian President Vladimir Putin. He has been castigated severely in recent months for gathering too much political power to himself. But according to former Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, who was interviewed on U.S. television recently by David Brokaw, Putin has not imposed a tyranny upon Russia, yet. Gorbachev thinks the jury is still out on Putin. Or Putin. Perhaps with this in mind, we should be asking whether Vladimir Putin is a serious student of history. If he is, then he surely recognizes that the deepening crisis in the Persian Gulf presents not only manifold dangers but also opportunities. Be assured that the Russian leader has not forgotten the humiliating defeat Ronald Reagan inflicted upon the old Soviet states. Have we, Americans, forgotten? By the mid-1980s, the Soviets were in Kabul and had all but defeated the Mujahideen. The Soviet Union appeared secure in its military occupation of Afghanistan. But then, in 1986, the first U.S. Stinger missiles reached the hands of the Afghani resistance, and quite suddenly, Soviet helicopter gunships and MiGs began dropping out of the skies like flaming stones. The tide swiftly turned, and by 1989 it was all over, but the hand-wringing and gnashing of teeth in the Kremlin. Defeated, the Soviets slunk back across the frontier. The whole world cheered the American Stingers, which had carried the day. This very night, as he sips his cognac, what is Vladimir Putin thinking? Is he perhaps thinking about the perverse symmetries of history? Skipping down, one can almost hear the Russians' animated conversation. The Americans, what is the matter with them? They simply cannot help themselves. What idiots! A nation as foolish as this deserves to be taught a lesson. Yes, for their own good. It must be a painful lesson, one they will never forget. Are we agreed, then, comrades? Let us teach our American friends a lesson about the limits of military power. Does anyone really believe that Vladimir Putin will hesitate to seize a most rare opportunity to change the course of history and, in the bargain, take his sweet revenge? Surely he understands the terrible dimensions of the trap into which the U.S. has blundered. Skipping down. If the U.S. and Israel overreach, and the Iranians close the net with Russian anti-ship missiles, it will be a fearful symmetry indeed. And now I'm going to delineate the nightmare that might unfold if, in fact, the war of words turns hot. And I do think that we all need to do everything possible to see to it that that does not happen. At the Battle of Cannae in 216 BC, the great Carthaginian general Hannibal tempted a much larger Roman army into a fateful advance and then enveloped and annihilated it with a smaller force. Out of a Roman army of 70,000 men, no more than a few thousand escaped. It was said that after many hours of dispatching the Romans, Hannibal's soldiers grew so tired that the fight went out of them. In their weariness, they granted the last broken and bedraggled Romans their lives. Let us pray that the U.S. sailors who were unlucky enough to be on duty in the Persian Gulf when the shooting starts can escape the fate of the Roman army at Cannae. The odds will be heavily against them, however, because they will face the same type of danger tantamount to envelopment. The U.S. ships in the Gulf will already have come within range of the Sunburn missiles, and the even more advanced SSNX-26 Yakonts missiles, also Russian-made. Speed Mach 2.9, range 180 miles, deployed by the Iranians along the Gulf's northern shore. Every U.S. ship will be exposed and vulnerable. When the Iranians spring the trap, the entire lake will become a killing field. Anti-ship cruise missiles are not new, as I've mentioned, nor have they yet determined the outcome in a conflict. But this is probably only because these horrible weapons have never been deployed in sufficient numbers. At the time of the Falklands War, the Argentine Air Force possessed only 5 exocets, yet managed to sink 2 ships. With enough of them, the Argentinians might have sunk the entire British fleet and won the war. Although we've never seen a massed attack of cruise missiles, this is exactly what the U.S. Navy could face in the next war in the Gulf. Try and imagine this, if you can. Barrage after barrage of exocet-class missiles, which the Iranians are known to possess in the hundreds, parenthetically, the Argentinians possessed 5, as well as the unstoppable Sunburn and Yakonts missiles. The questions that our purblind government leaders should be asking themselves today, if they value what historians will one day write about them, are 2. How many of the Russian anti-ship missiles has Putin already supplied to Iran, and how many more are currently in the pipeline? In 2001, Jane's Defense Weekly reported that Iran was attempting to acquire anti-ship missiles from Russia. Ominously, the same report also mentioned that the more advanced Yakonts missile was optimized for attacks against carrier task forces, unquote. Apparently, its guidance system is able to distinguish an aircraft carrier from its escorts, unquote. The numbers were not disclosed. The U.S. Navy will come under fire even if the U.S. does not participate in the first so-called surgical raids on Iran's nuclear sites. That is, even if Israel goes it alone. Israel's brand-new fleet of 25 F-15s, paid for by American taxpayers, has sufficient range to target Iran, but the Israelis cannot mount an attack without crossing U.S.-occupied Iraqi airspace. It will hardly matter if Washington gives the green light or is dragged into the conflict by a recalcitrant Israel. Either way, the result will be the same. The Iranians will interpret U.S. acquiescence as complicity, and in any event, they will understand that the real fight is with the Americans. The Iranians will be entirely within their rights to counterattack in self-defense. Most of the world will see it this way and will support them, not America. The U.S. and Israel will be viewed as the aggressors, even as the unfortunate U.S. sailors in harm's way become cannon fodder. In the Gulf's shallow and confined waters, evasive maneuvers will be difficult at best and escape impossible. Even if U.S. planes control the skies over the battlefield, the sailors caught in the net below will be hard-pressed to survive. The Gulf will run red with American blood. From here, it only gets worse. Armed with their Russian-supplied cruise missiles, the Iranians will close the lake's only outlet, the strategic Strait of Hormuz, cutting off the trapped and dying Americans from help and rescue. The U.S. fleet in the Indian Ocean will stand by helplessly, unable to enter the Gulf to assist the survivors or bring logistical support to the other U.S. forces on duty in Iraq. Couple this with a major new ground offensive by the Iraqi insurgents, and quite suddenly, the tables could turn against the Americans in Baghdad. As supplies and ammunition begin to run out, the status of U.S. forces in the region will become precarious. The occupiers will become the besieged. With enough anti-ship missiles, the Iranians can halt tanker traffic through Hormuz for weeks, even months. With the flow of oil from the Gulf curtailed, the price of a barrel of crude will skyrocket on the world market. Within days, the global economy will begin to grind to a halt. Tempers at an emergency round-the-clock session of the UN Security Council will flare and likely explode into shouting and recriminations as French, German, Chinese, and even British ambassadors angrily accuse the U.S. of allowing Israel to threaten world order. But as always, because of the U.S. veto, the world body will be powerless to act. America will stand alone, completely isolated. Yet despite the increasingly hostile international mood, elements of the U.S. media will spin the crisis very differently here at home in a way that is sympathetic to Israel. Members of Congress will rise to speak in the House and Senate and rally to Israel's defense while blaming the victim of the attack, Iran. Fundamentalist Christian talk show hosts will proclaim the historic fulfillment of biblical prophecy in our time and will call upon the Jews of Israel to accept Jesus into their hearts, meanwhile urging the president to nuke the evil empire of Islam. From across America will be heard histrionic cries for fresh reinforcements, even a military draft. Patriots will demand victory at any cost. Pundits will scream for an escalation of the conflict. A war that ostensibly began as an attempt to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons will teeter on the brink of their use. Scary. Could happen. Might not happen, but it could happen. Again, I think that's a very important article, and I will give the full URL for it in the written description for the show. Again, it's an article that obviously has its prejudices. It is, however, a very important military analysis. We're going to examine the role of fundamentalist Christianity in American society, and in particular the Armageddon lobby and some of the implications of having that in the seat of power inside, too. There is a scenario, obviously hypothetical, another unappetizing scenario, somewhat less devastating for the world economy and probably the world's population as a whole. But as I've discussed in a number of programs, seismic weaponry has been a fact of life for some time. The U.S. and Soviets had a treaty on the books in the mid-70s about the use of Tesla technology to trigger earthquakes, tsunamis, and so forth. There's a major earthquake fault that runs through Tehran. And in the event that there was a major earthquake in Tehran, the possible loss of life could be enormous, and that would, in all probability, cripple Iranian society. I do not know what the capabilities, the specific operational capabilities of the HAARP system and related Tesla technologies are, but certainly it appears that it can cause earthquakes. With the degree of precision, or what the degree of precision is, I do not know, but we might see the whole thing resolve, albeit in another less bloody but nonetheless horrible scenario, with a seismic strike on Tehran. We will see what takes place. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 497, Nightmare, being recorded on January 30th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.